Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're navigating a really significant and often sensitive area, the core arguments underpinning the pro-life position.
Indeed, a complex topic.
We've gathered some compelling sources for this exploration. We've got philosophical insights from thinkers like Don Marquis and Alexander Proust, Frank Beckwith's responses to common pro-choice arguments, and also some pivotal biblical passages that frequently inform this perspective.
Right. A mix of philosophy, critique, and theology.
Our goal today really is to get beyond just the headlines and truly understand the fundamental reasoning at play in these specific pro-life arguments. Okay, let's unpack this.
Absolutely. And I think regardless of where anyone stands personally on this, understanding the, you know, the logical architecture of these arguments is pretty essential for thoughtful engagement.
That's the game.
We're here to basically illuminate the reasoning presented in these sources we looked at.
So let's jump right into the philosophical deep end. Maybe start with Don Marquis. He starts by posing a, well, it sounds simple, but it's a profoundly important question. When is killing wrong and why is it wrong?
The fundamental question.
Yeah. And his conclusion is fascinating. He argues it's not primarily about the act being, say, brutal or even the grief of those left behind. For Marquis, the fundamental wrong of killing is the deprivation of a valuable future for the one who was killed.
That's interesting. What's particularly insightful there is Marquis' shift in focus. He's not centering, like, on the suffering inflicted or even the societal consequences, but really on the profound loss experienced by the individual whose life is ended.
Exactly. He puts it this way, and it really kind of hits home. The loss of one's life deprives one of all the experiences, activities, projects, and enjoyments that would otherwise have constituted one's future.
Wow.
Yeah. Think about all the things, you know, any of us anticipate. Big milestones, everyday joys, even just the chance to see what tomorrow brings. That's what Marquis says is being taken away.
And if we connect this idea, this valuable future concept, to the topic at hand, abortion, you can really see how it forms the bedrock of his philosophical case against it.
Precisely. And the implications of this line of reasoning, according to Marquis anyway, extend beyond just human beings.
Yeah.
He suggests this framework gives us a way to understand why killing animals might also be considered wrong, you know, prima facie wrong, at least.
To some degree, yeah.
They too, he argues, have a future of experiences that gets cut short. Though he is careful, it seems, not to equate this directly with the loss of a human future.
Right. That's a crucial distinction. While Marquis posits that depriving any being of a valuable future is prima facie wrong, the content and the scope of that future likely play a significant role in our moral assessment.
How so?
Well, the capacity for complex thought, relationships, long-term projects, that might differentiate the value we inherently ascribe to different kinds of futures, you know, a human future versus, say, a dog's future.
That makes sense. He also applies this same idea to the issue of active euthanasia, but only in very specific cases where someone is terminally ill, facing only pain and a very, very limited future.
Okay.
In those specific circumstances, Marquis argues that perhaps hastening death wouldn't be depriving them of a truly valuable future in the same way.
It's important to probably underscore that Marquis isn't advocating for, like, widespread euthanasia here. He's more exploring the logical boundaries of his argument about the wrongness of killing, using extreme cases to test the principle.
Right, testing the limits. And this brings us right to the core of our discussion today. Marquis contends that his view provides a powerful argument against killing children, infants, and fetuses.
Okay.
And here's the really interesting part. He arrives at this conclusion without needing to define exactly when a fetus becomes a person.
Oh, that's key.
Yeah. His argument hinges solely on the idea that a fetus, just like a child or an adult, has a valuable future that would be extinguished by being killed.
Exactly. By focusing on that potential, the future filled with experiences and development, he sort of elegantly sidesteps the often intractable debate about fetal personhood while still making a significant pro-life argument.
He also notes that his argument neatly resolves any perceived conflict with contraception.
How so?
Because as he sees it, contraception prevents a valuable future from ever beginning. It doesn't deprive an existing individual of one. There isn't, like, a who there yet with that potential future to be deprived.
Okay. That's a key distinction in his reasoning. Preventing a potentiality from being realized is morally different, in his view, from ending an existing life with its inherent future prospects.
Now, as you can imagine, Marquis' argument has faced its share of scrutiny. One common objection is the apparent, you know, chasm between an adult human being with our consciousness, self-awareness, complex lives, and a fetus, which seems to lack these capacities, at least initially.
Right.
This objection raises fundamental questions about what actually constitutes moral status. Is it tied to our current capacities or potential trajectory? You know, is the me now fundamentally different from the fetus I once was?
And Marquis's response to this is quite direct. He argues that while we might be very different personally at different stages of development, we are the same organism throughout.
The biological entity.
Yeah, think of like a caterpillar turning into a butterfly. Same biological entity, radically different forms. He argues it's the same continuous life, just at different points along the way.
Okay.
And this philosopher, Alexander Proust, takes this very idea and really expands on it, which actually leads us nicely to our next key philosophical argument.
Yes, Proust's central argument is, well, remarkably straightforward on the surface, yet very powerful.
Right.
I once was a fetus.
Exactly. It's a universal truth, isn't it? No one can deny that.
And from this seemingly simple premise, Proust builds a compelling case. He argues that if it is wrong to end my life now, then by the same logic, it would have been wrong to end my life when I was a fetus.
Therefore,
he concludes, a fetus deserves the same fundamental moral respect as an adult in comparable circumstances.
The linchpin of his argument is this concept of the continuity of the organism, the biological entity that came into existence at conception. Proust uses his own example, being conceived during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Wow, that's specific.
Yeah. He says that entity has never ceased to exist. It has simply undergone a continuous process of development and maturation. It wasn't like one entity disappeared and another one suddenly popped up.
Right. There wasn't a break in the chain of being, so to speak. It's just one ongoing life.
Precisely. Now, one of the more intriguing challenges to this idea of a single, continuous individual organism is the possibility of twinning.
Yeah.
You know, when a very early embryo, a blastocyst, splits and develops into two separate individuals.
Oh, yeah. Identical twins.
Exactly. If this can happen, does it mean there weren't really two individuals somehow contained within that initial single entity? It's a bit mind-bending to think that I could have been a we.
It is, and Proust addresses this. He notes that while twinning does occur, it's relatively rare, happening in about, what, one in every 260 blastocysts, the source said.
Okay, not super common.
Right, and his counter-argument is that the mere potential for splitting in the future doesn't negate the fact that prior to any split, there is still a genuine individual organism present.
So he's essentially arguing that the possibility of a future division doesn't retroactively change the ontological status, the beingness of the organism before that division might occur. It's still a distinct entity progressing along its developmental pathway.
And here's a perspective from Proust that really makes you stop and think. He even posits that, in a way, ending the life of a fetus might be considered more wrong than ending the life of an adult.
More wrong.
Simply because the fetus has a potentially much longer span of valuable future life ahead of it. Someone in their later years might have, you know, a limited number of years remaining. Whereas a fetus, if carried to term, could have decades and decades of experiences ahead.
That introduces an interesting dimension to our understanding of the value of life, not just the intrinsic value of existing right now, but also the potential quantity of future life lost.
Now, what about those really difficult situations? What if the mother's life is genuinely in danger? Or maybe if the fetus is diagnosed with a very severe and life-limiting condition?
Yeah, hard cases.
Proust suggests that these tragic cases should be approached with the same moral framework we would apply to similar situations involving a fully developed adult, assuming we grant the fetus that comparable moral status.
Right. This highlights the inherent complexities in applying these broad moral principles to the very nuanced, often heartbreaking realities of individual circumstances. It forces us to grapple with how we weigh competing values and potential harms in deeply difficult situations.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's also the objection that, well, an embryo that, for whatever reason, maybe never implants or just doesn't develop into a person, that it doesn't have the same claim to rights. A philosopher named Don Berkich raised this point.
Okay.
But then Daniel Probson, defending Proust's line of thought, argues that in the case of abortion, it is precisely the act of abortion itself that prevents that embryo from ever realizing its potential to become a person.
Oh, it's a crucial point about causality. The very reason that embryo doesn't progress is the direct result of an intentional intervention.
Exactly. It's a fascinating philosophical dance, really. Okay, so we've explored these fundamental philosophical arguments. Now, let's maybe shift our focus a bit to Frank Beckwith and his responses to some of the more commonly cited arguments in favor of abortion rights.
Right. Beckwith brings a sharp analytical perspective to some of the data and the analogies that frequently appear in these discussions.
Okay, so one argument we hear quite often is that abortion is significantly safer for the woman than carrying a pregnancy to term and giving birth.
Yes, the safety argument.
Proponents often point to statistics showing a much lower mortality rate for first trimester abortions compared to childbirth. And, you know, on the surface, it can sound like a very compelling point.
It certainly does, but Beckwith encourages us to delve deeper into the numbers and, importantly, consider the overall context.
Okay.
While the mortality rate is indeed lower for abortion, the sources mentioned 1 in 100,000 for first trimester abortion versus 9 in 100,000 for childbirth.
Right. That sounds like a big difference. 9 times safer.
It does, but Beckwith emphasizes the remarkably high survival rates in both scenarios. He points out that the survival rate for the woman undergoing a first trimester abortion is around 99.999%, and for childbirth, it's approximately 99.991%.
Oh, okay.
The absolute difference, he argues, is actually quite small, only about 0.008%.
That really reframes the comparison, doesn't it? When you look at it in terms of overall survival probability, the difference seems much less dramatic than just saying one is 9 times safer.
Exactly. And Beckwith takes his argument even a step further. He contends that even if childbirth were demonstrably significantly more dangerous than abortion, the inherent moral obligation that parents have towards their offspring outweighs the desire to avoid that slightly increased risk.
Interesting. So a moral obligation trumps the risk difference.
That's his argument. He argues this sense of parental obligation is a foundational aspect of human society. He even suggests that throughout history, even when childbirth posed vastly greater risks than it does today, this fundamental obligation was still recognized.
Now, he also takes on Judith Jarvis Thompson's widely discussed violinist analogy.
Ah, yes, the famous violinist.
Yeah, for listeners who might not be familiar, it asks you to imagine waking up surgically connected to a famous violinist who needs your kidneys, essentially, and will die if you unplug yourself. This is often used to argue that a woman should have the right to unplug from an unwanted pregnancy.
It's a very vivid thought experiment, but Beckwith raises a couple of key objections to its application here.
Okay, what are they?
Firstly, he argues that Thompson's analogy implicitly assumes that we only have obligations to others if we have voluntarily chosen to undertake those obligations.
Right, like you didn't volunteer to be hooked up to the violinist.
Exactly. But Beckwith counters this by asserting that our obligations to our children are inherent and natural, stemming from the very fact that they are our offspring, regardless of the circumstances of their conception.
So not based on choice alone.
Right. Think about a father who unexpectedly discovers he has a child. We still generally recognize his moral obligations towards that child, right? Beckwith believes that this emphasis on pure voluntarism, as he calls it, actually undermines the very notion of familial responsibility.
Okay, that's one point. What's the second?
His second major point of contention is a critical dissimilarity, a disanalogy between the two scenarios. He argues that the dependence of an unborn child on its mother is a natural biological relationship.
Right, part of nature.
Whereas the violinist's dependence on you and the thought experiment is entirely artificial and imposed without your consent in that scenario. You are effectively kidnapped and connected.
I see. So natural dependence versus artificial dependence.
Precisely. He contends that this fundamental difference, the natural biological bond versus the artificial imposed connection, renders the analogy flawed when applied to the issue of abortion. The natural dependence of a child on its mother creates a unique moral context that the analogy just fails to capture, in his view.
Right. It's like comparing, I don't know, a naturally occurring ecosystem to a completely contrived and temporary lab setup. Okay, so we've journeyed through some complex philosophical arguments and Beckwith's responses. Now let's turn our attention to the biblical perspective often presented in the pro-life discussion.
Yes, for many who hold a pro-life view, the Bible serves as a really foundational text, and there are several passages that are frequently cited to support this position.
One particularly resonant passage is Psalm 139, specifically verses 13 through 16. This is a really beautiful and powerful depiction of God's intimate involvement in the creation of each individual in the womb. The psalmist writes, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." This really underscores a sense of divine design and awareness from the very earliest stages of life.
It conveys a profound sense of God's personal care and deliberate action in the formation of every human being, even before birth. That knitting together imagery is quite striking.
It is. We see a similar theme in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 1, verse 5, where God tells the prophet Jeremiah, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you."
Knew you before formation.
Yeah. This suggests that God had a prior relationship, or at least knowledge, and a plan for Jeremiah even before he was conceived or formed, again highlighting the inherent value and significance of life within the womb from this perspective.
This concept of God's foreknowledge and preordained purpose for individuals before their birth is actually a recurring motif in Scripture. It implies a divine recognition of personhood, or at least individual identity, prior to birth.
Another point frequently brought up is the fact that the Bible sometimes refers to unborn babies using terms that seem to suggest personhood, like in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 1.
With Elizabeth and Mary.
Exactly. When Mary greets Elizabeth, who is pregnant with John the Baptist, the scripture says that the baby in Elizabeth's womb leapt for joy.
Leapt for joy.
Yeah. That description, using the language of a conscious reaction, implies to some a certain level of being more than just, you know, undifferentiated tissue.
The use of such language certainly lends itself to the interpretation that the unborn are viewed as more than mere biological matter within the biblical narrative. That reaction attributed to John the Baptist suggests a recognition of personhood, at least in a theological sense, within that context.
Now, the passage in Exodus 21, the one dealing with accidental harm to a pregnant woman, that one is particularly interesting and has been the subject of a lot of discussion and different interpretations.
Right, the penalty passage.
Yeah. The key Hebrew phrase, Yetsu Yeladeha, which describes the outcome if the woman is struck, can be translated in different ways. Sometimes it's rendered as miscarriage, but other times as her child comes out.
And the way this passage is translated has pretty significant implications for how we understand the moral status of the unborn in biblical law, doesn't it?
Absolutely. If it's translated as miscarriage, it might suggest a lesser penalty than for harm caused to the woman herself, perhaps implying a lesser status for the fetus. But if it's translated as her child comes out, it implies that the prematurely born infant is considered a living child, subject to the legal protections and consequences outlined in the rest of the passage, like the eye for an eye principle if further harm occurs.
And according to our sources, the more accurate translation of Yetsu Yeladeha is indeed her child comes out, or perhaps her children come out, plural.
Right. And that interpretation, if correct, definitely strengthens the pro-life perspective drawn from this passage, as it suggests that harm resulting in the premature birth of a child carried serious consequences under biblical law, implying a recognition of the value of that unborn or newly born life.
It really underscores how careful attention to the nuances of the original language can reveal deeper insights, or at least different potential interpretations, of the biblical understanding of the unborn.
Finally, our sources point to other instances in the Bible where God seems to call or speak about individuals before they are born, like Paul in Galatians chapter 1, Isaiah in chapter 49, Samson in Judges 13, even Jacob and Esau in Genesis chapter 25.
Right. These recurring themes throughout both the Old and New Testaments contribute to the theological arguments supporting the pro-life view, emphasizing the sanctity of life from its very beginning, as understood within that religious framework.
Okay, so we've journeyed through these philosophical and biblical arguments. Our sources also address some of the common arguments made in support of abortion rights and how those holding a pro-life view often respond.
Yes, the counter-arguments.
We hear these frequently. A woman's fundamental right to make decisions about her own body.
Bodily autonomy, yes.
The concern that restricting abortion will just lead to dangerous, illegal, back-alley abortions. I think Ted Kennedy was mentioned raising this point historically.
Well, with the public health argument.
The significant financial burdens that unwanted pregnancies and raising children can place on women.
Economic hardship, a very real concern.
And the difficult, often tragic circumstances of not wanting to force women to bring unwanted children or perhaps children with severe disabilities into the world.
These are undeniably weighty and complex considerations. They touch on very real human struggles and deserve serious attention and empathy.
Absolutely. But the central pro-life counterargument, as articulated by thinkers like Scott Ray and our sources, often revolves around the idea that many of these arguments, while addressing real and important concerns, fundamentally sidestep, or maybe beg the question regarding the core issue, the moral status of the fetus.
How so? Beg the question.
Well, the argument is that they often implicitly assume that the fetus is not a being with its own inherent right to life. If you start from that assumption, then bodily autonomy safety, and financial concerns naturally take precedence.
I see. So the crux of the pro-life response here is that if the fetus is indeed considered to be a human being with moral standing, which is the conclusion drawn from the arguments we discussed earlier.
Right, from Marquis, Prowse, the biblical interpretations.
Then the ethical calculus changes dramatically. The woman's right to bodily autonomy, while significant, would then need to be weighed against what they consider to be the fundamental right to life of another distinct human being.
Exactly. If the fetus is seen as possessing the same fundamental right to life as any born human, then concerns about the dangers of illegal abortions, financial hardship, or the challenges of raising an unwanted child, while still important societal problems that definitely need addressing, become secondary in this view to the fundamental right to life of that fetus.
Because the fetus isn't seen as merely a part of the woman's body, but as a separate individual organism with its own claim to life.
Precisely. It brings us right back to that foundational question of the moral status of the fetus, a question that these pro-life arguments attempt to answer through these different lenses, philosophical reasoning about valuable futures, the continuity of the organism, and theological perspectives on divine creation and the inherent value of unborn life.
It's a complex web of reasoning.
It really is. So to sort of bring our deep dive to a close here, we've really examined the core reasoning presented in our sources for the pro-life position. We've looked at Marquis' concept of the wrongness of killing being the deprivation of a valuable future.
Proust's powerful argument rooted in the idea that I once was a fetus and the continuous nature of the organism.
Beckwith's critical analysis of the safer than childbirth argument and his critique of the violinist analogy.
And the biblical emphasis on God's intimate involvement in creating the unborn. And the scriptural references to them, often as children.
It's vital, though, to remember, as we always say, that these are specific perspectives drawn from the particular sources we've delved into today.
Absolutely. The issue of abortion is incredibly complex, encompassing a huge range of deeply held ethical, philosophical, religious beliefs, personal experiences, and values. We've only explored one facet based on these texts.
Absolutely. And it's a conversation that continues to evolve and challenge our thinking, no doubt. So maybe as a final thought for our listeners to consider, how might this concept of a valuable future, which was the cornerstone of Marquis' argument, how might that potentially be applied to our understanding of other ethical dilemmas beyond just the debate we've had today?
Interesting question.
Could that framework offer us new ways to think about, say, the moral status of other beings or the significance of potential life in different contexts? It's certainly something to maybe continue mulling over.
Food for thought, definitely.
Indeed. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.